Brexit means Brexit, and we're going to make a success of it.
We have got a cast iron assurance and a guarantee from the British government.
The particular problems around the Irish border are being used politically to try to frustrate Brexit.
Northern Ireland must leave the European Union on the same terms as the rest of the United Kingdom.
Northern Ireland would form part of our customs territory.
Hello and welcome to Brexit Republic, RTE's podcast on Brexit. I'm Tony Connolly, RTE's Europe editor in Brussels.
And I'm Sean Whelan, RTE's London correspondent in Westminster.
And I'm Colm O'Mungine, RTE's deputy foreign editor in Dublin. Each week, Brexit Republic assesses all the latest Brexit developments in Brussels, London and Dublin.
No prizes for guessing what day it is. Today, it's Halloween. More to the point, it's not Brexit Day, despite Boris Johnson's do-or-die, come-what-may vow to get Britain out of the EU by October 31st.
But it's also day one of what promises to be a bruising and bitter general election contest. I'll be looking at how we got here, what the issues will be, and why anyone would be mad to predict the outcome.
We'll also look at how the EU managed the will-they-won't-they question of what kind of extension to gift Boris Johnson.
And what Brussels will be doing while Britain tears itself apart over the next 7 weeks.
But first, Sean, Boris Johnson finally got the general election he craved. He's starting out having failed to deliver on his signature promise. If he's not dead in a ditch, how is he justifying the current situation?
Well, it's all Labour Party's fault, isn't it? Jeremy Corbyn in particular. At least that's what Boris Johnson is going around telling everybody. He has his deal with the European Union. He'd love to get it passed. He got his second stage reading approved by the House of Commons. He's got Brexit further than anybody else has managed to get it. And yet he still hasn't got it across the line by this all-important day.
But he withdrew the withdrawal agreement bill himself. How's he getting around that one? They took it off in order to pressure the Commons into giving him the general election he wanted on December 12th. It was his choice not to put the withdrawal agreement bill before the House beyond the second stage. Has he been pressed on that, or will it get that granular over the course of an election? Or does anyone care? Is this going to be about other things other than Brexit?
I would say nobody cares about the mechanics of Boris Johnson withdrawing bills or not withdrawing bills. We've at least got something happening here now. We have a general election. This is the parliament that will become famous for neither getting Brexit passed nor blocking Brexit. This parliament that's been around since 2017, really nothing has happened under its administration. So, yes, there was a sense that something had to give. It was becoming maddeningly frustrating for anybody watching the Brexit process, but for normal people as well, I'm sure, the length and breadth of this country, they were getting completely bamboozled by this whole escapade in the Parliament. Nothing going forward, nothing decisive happening. Having an election was the closest thing to being decisive that we saw, but even that couldn't be done in a decisive manner. First of all, on Monday, we had this Fixed-Term Parliament Act process to try and get an election where he needed two-thirds of the votes. 438 MPs had to vote for an early general election under the Fixed-Term Parliament Act. He couldn't get those numbers, couldn't get anywhere close to it. And so we had to come back on Tuesday when the government set down its own one-line bill, simply fixing December the 12th. As the election day. But even that simple plan could not be simply executed. The opposition decided they were going to string it out all day and were putting down amendments. There was squabbling about should it be the 9th of December or the 12th of December to do with turnouts in university towns. A number of them, the seats there are quite marginal. So having a large block of students around would be a good thing if you're trying to unseat an incumbent at the university term due to expire on the 13th. So they were worried that people would drift away before that. That was one excuse put forward for it. Another one was if the election was called for December the 9th, they would have to have had Parliament shut down by tonight. And that would not give them the government any time to try and railroad through a Brexit withdrawal agreement. That was a concern of the Scots Nationalists in particular. But you know, that was stringing out part of the day. Then Labour and a few others were looking to amend the bill to see could they include EU nationals on the electoral register. And then they thought, well, what about 16 and 17-year-olds? Because they're able to vote in Scottish and Welsh assembly and local elections. Why not have it included in all of England? And of course, it's supposed to be about the future and the youth, etc., etc. But of course, that would have added
not to mention the fact
cost.
That young people are quite remain minded for parties like the SNP and the Lib Dems and Labour to
indeed.
A large degree.
But famously also not very enthusiastic about turning out at election time. Whether the novelty of being able to vote at 16 might get some of them out is, of course, a moot point now. Those amendments didn't carry. But the other point is those amendments just ate up a lot of time, and the process of trying to pass a one-line bill became an all-day escapade. At the end of the day, no amendments were taken, none were accepted, and strangely enough, 438 MPs voted in favour of the one-line bill, exactly the same number that would have been required the night before to have passed a proposal under the Fixed Term Parliaments Act.
Now,
so, strange things happening over in the Palace of Westminster.
Now, it became untenable, really, the view was it was becoming untenable for Labour to keep blocking the election. It was making them look like they were running away from it. Labour had said they wanted a no-deal Brexit off the table before they could go along with this. And when the EU granted the extension, they said, well, there we go, no deal is off the table. But Tony, in reality, given that a transition period will come to an end at the end of 2020, is a no deal Brexit off the table? Does that hold water?
Well, you're right to say that this whole question of no deal Brexit could come back into the picture in July of next year, and I'll explain why in a minute. But it's true that the transition period runs out at the end of 2020. The original withdrawal agreement provides for an extension, a transition period to be extended, on the basis that you mightn't have the free trade agreement and the future relationship concluded within that time frame. So it could be extended for another 2 years to the end of 2022. But because we were meant to leave at the end of March, the transition period was being whittled away by that delay. And it means that if there's an election in December, which there will be, obviously, then a new government should be formed before Christmas. But nothing much will happen in terms of getting the withdrawal agreement over the line, probably until the new year, unless things move very quickly after the general election, which means that the new government will be getting into office at a time when the question of do they extend the transition period comes into view a few months down the line. So Boris Johnson has said that, and his team have said repeatedly, that the transition will end at the end of next year. Britain will be out at the end of next year, come what may.
Dead in a ditch.
Do or die, etc. Dead in a ditch. But obviously that's an issue that the House of Commons has grave reservations about. And that was one of the reasons why the House of Commons was clamouring for more time to go over the withdrawal agreement bill, to try and figure out how do we avoid another cliff edge happening at the end of 2020. And the other problem, of course, is that companies and businesses and people have been marched up the hill warning about a no-deal Brexit. They've done all their preparations. They have stockpiled. They have done their contingency planning.
Spent hard cash.
I mean, the British government's own advertising campaign for the end of this month cost 100 million. They reckon that Brexit planning so far has cost 6.3 billion pounds sterling. So at a certain point, it's like the boy who cried wolf. Eventually, businesses and the general public will stop believing that a no-deal Brexit will ever happen. I mean, I was trying to get through to one particular diplomat earlier this week on the question of the extension, and he said he couldn't pick up the phone because he was he was being called by his opposite numbers back at home in the national capital, who were saying, can we stand down the contingency planning now? Because a no deal Brexit is definitely off the table for the end of October. But you're right in that it is still a theoretical possibility at the end of next year.
Okay, Sean, the whole issue of missed deadlines, we saw it in March, we've seen it in October. The new Brexit deadline is for the 31st of January. But just to look through the timetable of the UK election, December 12th election, December 13th, a result, maybe, the election of a Prime Minister, we don't know when, we don't know what the result is going to be, when will a Queen's Speech come in, when will a withdrawal agreement bill be passed, and all of a sudden, we're coming up against Christmas, whether people want to reconvene before that, we're tipping over into January, and time is running out again.
Yeah, exactly. I mean, time is very short. Donald Tusk reminded the British in farewell tweet during the week. He said this is almost certainly the last extension, so please don't let this one slip by in the way that the previous extensions have been allowed to, or have been squandered effectively by British politics.
Well, he said that about the last one as well. He said use the time well between March and October. And he said this latest extension may be the latest.
Yeah, but I mean, it's the last one that'll happen under his watch. So that's another thing that we know for sure.
Right.
Donald Tusk is retiring. What is it, tomorrow night, Tony? He'll be gone off the scene.
And what about the French, Tony? How do we, you know, they were reputed to have opposed this. They wanted a shorter extension after the whole March debacle. How would they view another extension? How were they even cajoled or persuaded into agreeing to this one? Did the Western Balkans and their stance on Northern Macedonia and Albania mean that they'd kind of used up some political capital with other European governments?
Well, there was a bit of that. I mean, the French situation was very interesting because, as you say, back in April, they had held out on the extension and were adamant that there should be a short extension, not a long extension. And they were following precedent this time around. But essentially, the French wanted two things. They wanted to make sure that the deal was done in the House of Commons, that it got over the line. And they were worried that, you know, questions were starting to be asked about the detail of the new Irish protocol. There was obviously the whole question about whether you would have checks or what kind of checks you would have on goods going back and forth between Great Britain and Northern Ireland. And they were starting to worry that things were going to unravel. So they wanted to make sure that enough pressure was exerted, A, to get the deal over the line by threatening to have a very short extension, and B, the second thing that they wanted was to make sure that there was going to be a general election, because they felt that this was the thing that was going to finally lance the boil, you know, break this deadly impasse that we've all been agonising over for such a long time. And in fact, there was very close coordination between the Elysee Palace and Number 10 Downing Street over this. The French were trying to be as helpful as possible to Boris Johnson in his travails to try and get the withdrawal agreement bill passed in the House of Commons and to try and get the election passed. There was very rigorous briefing by the French side from the Elysee Palace on this point, that France was going to push for a very short extension, perhaps 2 weeks, not the 3 months to the end of January. Interestingly enough, when it came down to it, the way this whole process was managed at EU level was through the what we call co-repair, which is the 27 EU ambassadors. During those co-repair meetings last week and early this week, the French were rather muted in their arguments and just saying things like, well, we have to, you know, make sure that, you know, we have agency here. We have, as the EU, have sovereignty over our decision, that we're not being pushed or cajoled into something, and that we're not dragged into the terrible messy wrangling of Westminster, because then we'd be accused of siding with one party or the other. Now, in the event, it was actually the Liberal Democrats and the Scottish Nationalists who got the French out of a jam, because they signalled last Friday that they would support Boris Johnson in getting an early general election. They wanted the 9th of December, as Sean has probably mentioned. In the end, it went to the 12th. But that kind of got everybody off the hook, this very strange and unexpected alliance between the SNP, the Liberal Democrats, and Boris Johnson's aspirations. But you were right in that the French were had somewhat irritated Donald Tusk by vetoing accession negotiations for Macedonia, and in turn they were somewhat blindsided by quite an assertive tweet by Donald Tusk on the 22nd of October, that was Tuesday a week ago, who said that he had spoken to Boris Johnson. He said, following his decision to pause the process of ratification of the withdrawal agreement and in order to avoid a no-deal Brexit, I will recommend that the EU27 accept the UK request for an extension. Now, that was quite a bold move that by Donald Tusk, who the French felt that he had really jumped the gun there by making such an assertive statement without necessarily getting everybody and all the capitals on board. The other question to take into account was whether or not this could be done by what's called a written procedure. In other words, officials would just agree it to then avoid the summit. And because nobody wanted to be dragged back to Brussels for another summit, that helped to kind of isolate the French a little bit more, because if there was going to be any dissent by a member state with the French looking for a 2-week extension, then if there was that level of dissent, everybody would have had to come back to Brussels for the summit. So I think there was quite a careful little piece of thumbscrew management by Donald Tusk. And then the question of the Liberal Democrats and the SNP helped to get this question resolved.
So back in London, Sean, the landscape for the election, the Liberal Democrats and the SNP, unapologetic remainers, they didn't want to see the withdrawal agreement bill being pushed through before an election, and presumably pitting themselves as the pro-Remain parties in the upcoming election. It suits them to enter into an election without Brexit done. It suits Boris Johnson to do a parliament against the people. The only people who were, I suppose, ambiguous about this or ambivalent about it were the Labour Party, whose stance on Brexit isn't as clear, and who needed a way into getting into this election, a ladder to save face.
Yeah, and I think the Boris Johnson would not be entirely happy about going into the election with Brexit undone. It would actually be a lot easier for him if he could come in and say, look, I am the one who delivered Brexit. Give me another crack at this. And it would be easier because he would have the monkey of the Brexit Party off of his back. Boris Johnson's rise as the deliverer, or an almost deliverer of Brexit, has coincided with a fall in the opinion poll ratings and the general chatter about the Brexit Party. They've been incredibly quiet over these last couple of weeks.
Yeah, they haven't declared their hand. When you mentioned them being a monkey on Boris Johnson's back, how problematic a primate are they, and in what constituencies?
Well, they have selected candidates across all of the constituencies, so they say they have people ready to go. But one of their leading lights during the week said we should actually concentrate our fire on just 20 marginal constituencies and try and help the Conservatives to achieve a majority in the parliament, or get enough seats that we could go in with them, that are, you know, pick whatever number you like out of that 20, would help to make up the numbers, and that way we could ensure that Brexit gets delivered. That's sparked some internal debate in the party. There have also been some more rumours about internal divisions, whether Aaron Banks, the key money bags behind the party, is still on board fully with them or not. That may all have something to do with the rather uncharacteristic, the quiet nature of Nigel Farage at the moment. But again, they have to wait and see. So is this going to be a three-way or a four-way fight, or a four-way plus the Scottish National Party? Because by all indications, they're going to hoover up most of the seats in Scotland. So Scotland is not going to be a happy hunting ground for either Labour or the Conservatives, or the Brexit Party. Or indeed the Liberal Democrats. So it's the rest of the territory. It's England and Wales is where they are going to be trying to fight the battleground. And if Johnson can go in as the guy who is the person who can say, look, I will deliver a Brexit to you, That's his key calling card. But he's also got all his fallback positions about the three things that people want to talk about, according to the Conservatives, which is the health service, then law and order, and investment in education. The Labour Party, of course, have a much bigger plan to fight an election about the nature of politics, society and the economy in Britain, and really downplay or perhaps marginalise entirely Brexit, because, as you say, they have a fairly convoluted stance on it. They have quite a few of their deputies or MPs who are elected from Remain voting constituencies, but they also have the bulk of the membership of the party would be inclined to remain in the European Union. And so they're trying to ride two horses at the same time. So perhaps from their point of view, the less said about Brexit, the better in this election.
Well, what Tory party is fighting this election, just to go back to the Tories and the Brexit party, because there are 58 MPs from the current parliament not standing. That's not unprecedented. It sounds like a large figure, but it's not unprecedented by any manner or means. I think 149 didn't contest after the expenses scandal some years ago. But it's changing the face somewhat of the Tory party. Those that are standing down would be regarded as moderate, middle ground, one nation Tories. And the character, they speculate, the character of the Tory party is changing in a more Brexit direction.
Yeah, I mean, the character of the party has been changing over the last 30 years, really. I remember meeting an MP actually 30 years ago at an event here in London, and he was saying, I have to go now because I have to go to my constituency party where they're trying to get rid of me because there's a faction trying to take over this party and get rid of people like me who believe in the European Union. And 30 years on, there's still a few people in the Conservative Party who believe in the European Union, but there'll be even fewer of them coming back after this election. We're seeing a lot of the I guess the old guard, in the case of Kenneth Clark, yeah, it's probably time for him to retire, all right. But other people like Nicky Morgan today, a cabinet minister, saying she's not going to stand. And pinning it on sort of family reasons, she'd like to see her children, etc. It is a tough and grueling existence, both as an MP and particularly as a cabinet minister. But even so, you're right, there's a sense that there is a loss, a big erosion of that one nation centre ground Conservative Party, and that it is tilting more and more to the right with a more radical right agenda, not just on the European Union, but across the piece on taxation and society. And in fact, Boris Johnson would probably fit more closely into that one nation centre ground of the Conservative Party and would be more naturally at home there. And yet he finds himself at the head of a party which is moving in a more rightward direction.
Tony, the Labour Party, Sean mentioned there, a somewhat convoluted stance on Brexit, even though they say it's absolutely clear. But one of the central parts of that is this idea that there could be a Labour renegotiation of Brexit and a more middle ground Brexit achieved. What could they do? Would it all be in the future relationship end of things, or is there any room for renegotiation, bearing in mind that all sides had said in previous iterations that there would be no further negotiation? But what would be achievable were a Labour government to be successful?
Well, it's interesting you should bring that up, because Labour is never properly challenged and tested on that, I think, by the Conservative opponents or by broadcasters in the UK. I mean, I think it's pretty inconceivable at this stage that the EU would contemplate sitting down once again with a British political party to renegotiate a withdrawal agreement. Now, yes, they did it with Boris Johnson, but if you actually look at what happened, the only part of the withdrawal agreement that they renegotiated or revised was the Irish Protocol. And what they did there was they kind of tweaked it back to Theresa May's withdrawal agreement protocol, which was a much more Northern Ireland specific option. And they changed the approach in terms of making it not so much an insurance policy, but a permanent settlement for Northern Ireland. And then this rather convoluted customs partnership idea, which was borrowed from elsewhere. But the point there was that the EU always said that they would look at options that delivered the same outcome as the backstop. And that outcome was that they would have no hard border on the island of Ireland, and you would protect North-South cooperation and the peace process and so on. So the EU could conceivably say, well, look, yes, we tweaked it, but it wasn't really a renegotiation. So the idea that Labour could come along and wholesale ask for a renegotiation of the actual divorce treaty, to me, is entirely fanciful. To follow on your earlier point, of course, they can go down the political declaration route, which is non-binding, and Labour has talked about having a much closer relationship to the customs union. They actually want a customs union with the EU. That could be done through the political declaration, but it would take some time, I think, to work that out. And, you know, they would have to sign up to a lot of what are called level playing field provisions. And, of course, once you go down that road, people might then say, well, what's the point of leaving the EU if we can't have our own independent trade policy, if we're going to have to cleave to EU rules on social rights, on state aid, on taxation, on environmental standards and so on. And again, that's in a whole other debate when it comes to the second referendum.
And the other thing about Labour's policy, Sean, and you might want to comment on this as well, is that heretofore they wanted a Norway-type arrangement. But one of the things they didn't want was freedom of movement. And going right back to the very beginning of the Brexit negotiations and everything else, and even David Cameron's attempts to renegotiate Britain's relationship with the European Union within the European Union, freedom of movement was one of those things that the European Union was saying it would absolutely not compromise on. Labour's closer relationship with the European Union still has some problematic issues that would intrude on UK or on EU red lines?
Well, it does, but I mean, just to get back to the point about, I mean, their proposition to the punters is if we get back into power as a government, we seek to negotiate a customs union and single market membership for the UK as part of our deal, and then put that to a referendum of the people. Now, Tony has said quite rightly and understandably, the EU don't want to get back into a negotiation as far as they're concerned. They've done all the negotiation they really want to do. But there's still leverage here because they haven't ratified that withdrawal agreement and we're heading up to a deadline of the 31st. Supposing a Labour government got into power in this country, they could be the ones then not ratifying an agreement that they didn't want and said, we don't want to ratify this. We want to have a renegotiation of it, a short, swift one, and have a referendum on the outcome of it in, say, May, because it could be done, and we want to get closer and closer to the EU. It would be pretty hard for the EU, having always said, we don't want to be the ones who would throw Britain out by having a hard Brexit caused by a no-deal Brexit caused by a non-ratification of an agreement, if they had that gun put to their head by people who said, we actually want to get closer to you, they might actually have to fold and agree to another negotiation with them. So that, I think, is the Labour Party calculus there. On the issue of free movement, yes, it is problematic, particularly, as I say, in those Leaver voting constituencies, which are often very depressed parts of the United Kingdom. But again, as was pointed out to Cameron at the time that he was trying to get restrictions placed on the freedom of movement principles of the European Union, there's lots of things that the British could do themselves, but have chosen not to do historically. The whole freedom of movement principle rests on having a 90-day period or 3 months where you're free to go to another country and look for a job. But at the end of 3 months, if you haven't got a job, you can't support yourself, that country is free to say, here's the gate, pal, away with you. That's really hard to do here in Britain because there's no register of the population. People can just come and go and set themselves up. There's no identity card system, for example. And we've seen the Irish state struggling to get a de facto identity card system operating there. It's not an easy thing to do, but there'd be an awful lot of resistance to it in Britain. But if they did have one, it's easier to manage your population if you actually know who your population is, what it consists of, where they've come from, and under what terms and conditions they've entered the country. Because if people come in, overstay their 90-day period, don't get themselves set up, it is theoretically and legally possible for a government to invite them to leave the country, even though they be European Union citizens.
Well, one thing we do know is, at least over the last week, and indeed repeatedly over the last few months, the Taoiseach here has said there won't be an election in Ireland this side of the new year. He said his preference is for May. Fianna Fáil, the main opposition party, saying their preference is for the spring. And the rationale, as they laid it out, was that the last time there was an election, there wasn't a clear result. The election took place on the 26th of February. There wasn't a Taoiseach elected until the 6th of May. And that kind of uncertainty at the time of Brexit is something that they don't want to have during next year. But if there is an unclear election result in the UK around the time of the 31st of January, Tony, what would be, do you think, the attitude towards having an extension?
Well, I think Sean's right in that there is this question of the damn thing being ratified. I mean, everybody in Europe now is focused on that. And, you know, Boris Johnson going for an election is one thing, but, you know, he did pull the ratification process of the withdrawal agreement bill, and that is still a bit of a gamble as far as the EU is concerned. But the hope is that, you know, the election will throw up a decisive result and things will move in January. I mean, we just can't predict what would happen. And as Sean says, you know, the EU has always wanted to avoid being the you know, the people who push Britain out if they're not ready to leave. And of course, you know, having granted three extensions so far, maybe even four if you count some of the earlier technical manoeuvrings back in March, you know, the EU has got used to granting an extension. I think another thing to look at, and Sean will probably want to chip in here as well, is that, you know, the withdrawal agreement bill foresees an awful lot of scrutiny of the next stage of the Brexit process, which is the future relationship, the trade negotiations. The House of Commons has been promised to have a decisive role in those trade negotiations, and MPs will want to see exactly what that what their involvement will be in those trade negotiations. But the problem is that in order to make sure he's not siphoning off votes to the Brexit Party, Boris Johnson in the campaign might take a fairly hard Brexit position, and that means that, you know, getting back to the question of do they extend the transition period, what kind of free trade agreement does he want? Does he want a very bare bones free trade agreement? What will that mean for workers' rights, for the environment, and so on? And, you know, once this election is over, you're going to have a whole cohort of new MPs who will not be that familiar with parliamentary procedure and who will not be that familiar with the kind of workings of the withdrawal agreement itself. So there is the risk that, you know, getting the withdrawal agreement ratified anyway, no matter who's elected, is going to take quite a long time. Boris Johnson may say things during the general election campaign that he's held to afterwards that might contradict the things he's actually trying to do afterwards in order to get MPs on board, in order to get MPs to sign up to this kind of mandate that they will have in these new negotiations. And all of that is going to feed into the sense that the House of Commons and the new British government are not ready to take the big question early next year of do they want to transition or extend it or not, because it seems to me and to most observers that it would be extremely unlikely for the UK to have a free trade agreement and a future relationship done and dusted by the end of next year. And the other question as well, just while I'm at it, is that, you know, if it is a bare bones free trade agreement, like a Canada Dry style agreement, which they've been talking about, yes, that could be done quicker. But there's every likelihood that national parliaments are going to want to scrutinise that free trade agreement late next year if it's done quickly. And that's 32 parliaments altogether when you include the Belgian parliaments.
Let's not forget Wallonia. Yeah.
Let's not forget Wallonia, absolutely, and the UK Parliament as well, that will have to ratify a, you know, potentially huge and unprecedented association agreement or free trade agreement between the United Kingdom, the fifth biggest economy, and the European Union, the biggest trading bloc in the world, with all the other issues about security and policing and judicial cooperation and so on.
Sean, as we record this on Thursday, the 31st of October, What are the numbers like in terms of the opinion polls?
The opinion polls are showing a clear lead for the Conservative Party over the Labour Party, varying between 11 and 16 percentage points, depending on which polls you're looking at. But it's a pretty chunky lead. But of course, they're very quick to remind us all that Theresa May had a very chunky lead when she called that snap election back in 2017. But Jeremy Corbyn surprised everybody with just how effective he was as a campaigner. And people talk about Boris Johnson being a people person and a campaign, big campaign asset in the way that Theresa May just wasn't. But Corbyn is also, campaigning is his natural habitat, not so much a House of Commons performer, but definitely a stump politician. So he can close the gap. He's closed the gap previously. They're also promising to have the most radical offering that any government has come up with or any party has come up with in a generation, and offering this once in a generation prospect of change in the same messianic way that Brexiters were suggesting that by voting for Brexit, the miserable condition that many Britons find themselves in could be transformed. The Labour Party can also offer an alternative way of transforming the lot of very many people in the country, and that might well resonate. And so just looking at the raw numbers, it is, I think, not a guide at this particular time. But then we have to add on the overlay of the Brexit issue itself and the positioning that we were talking about earlier of the parties here, with the Liberal Democrats had enjoyed a fairly substantial uptick in their support. It has flattened out in the last 2 or 3 months since Boris Johnson clearly got going as a prime minister and as a leader of the Conservative Party. Nevertheless, in an election campaign, they can offer that very clear alternative. We are the Stop Brexit Party. That's their USP in this election. They might gain seats there. And then you have the other end of that spectrum of the Brexit Party doing what it says on the tin and picking up votes there. And in that situation where, you know, even the Brexit Party on about 11 percentage points, the Liberal Democrats closing in on 20, Labour in sort of 23, 24 points at the moment, you are looking at possibly four-way splits in the votes, and that becomes not a national issue. Under the British electoral system, they talk about the swing from one party to another. That's probably less relevant now, in that we have several hundred individual battlegrounds in all of these constituencies, depending on whether Liberal Democrats are gaining ground or Brexit Party are gaining ground, Labour are losing, Conservatives losing, whatever. Pick your combinations there. It is incredibly difficult to predict this election because of the fissures through the electorate, that there are signs from other types of polling that people have become polarised on the issue of Brexit, and they're either for it or against it. And so then you've got the splits within the parties, the pro-Leave Labour people, the pro-Remain Labour people, their opposite numbers, fewer of them, admittedly, in the Conservative Party, and then these external other party choices that people are faced with. So trying to predict what way this election is going to bounce is extremely difficult. The cephalologists are saying that the Conservatives would need a pretty exceptional pickup in their fortunes, even from where they stand now, in order to come back with a majority. And the same would be true, but to a greater extent, of the Labour Party. So the odds at the moment seem to be on once again having a hung parliament when we come back. And then we're into those issues that Tony was talking about a few minutes ago of nobody being in command. How long is it going to take to put a government together? And how long is it then going to be before the government makes up its mind whether to push ahead with the withdrawal agreement, or if it's a Labour-led administration, are they going to try and renegotiate? Or if there's relying on other parties to make up the numbers, does that make for a harder or a softer or an anti-Brexit stance by the party? So really, we are going to be waiting on the election result. And Friday the 13th, an ill-starred day, a date, could well be the day.
EU leaders will be in Brussels at that time as well, watching the results roll in with
Exactly, overnight there'd be no sleep at the summit that night. Yeah. It's going to be a real political nerd fest on that night at the 12th, 13th.
Okay.
But you know, normally you wake up to either the shock or the pleasure of discovering who the British Prime Minister is going to be on the 13th. That wasn't clear last time. It's definitely, well, sorry, we can't use the word definitely.
Not allowed to use the word definitely.
No, definitely not.
Not in this podcast we can't, but the prospects of having a certain clear winner on the 13th, certainly as we look at it now on the 31st of October, are pretty far distant, I think.
Well, political consultants, polling agencies and public relations firms are probably the clear winners in all of this. And Tony has already mentioned $100 million spent on an awareness campaign about a no-deal Brexit in the UK already. Well, that's it for another edition of Brexit Republic. From me, Colm O'Mungoyne, Deputy Foreign Editor here in Dublin.
From me, Sean Whelan, London correspondent in London.
And from me, Tony Connolly, RTE's Europe Editor here in Brussels. Thanks for listening.